Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast today is Spider Stacey, who will be very well known to fans of the Pogues. He is an exceptional musician, player of the tin whistle and occasional singer for the Pogues as well. So, Spider, it's absolutely fabulous to get you on the Godcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Yeah, very well. Thank you.
Where in the world are you, Spider?
I'm in London right now, in Finsbury Park.
Okay. Is London a good place to live at this during the pandemic, or has it been a pain?
Well, actually, I mean, like, it's been okay. I can't really, from a personal point of view, I can't complain too much. You know, we've actually had things pretty easy, really, in this house, at least. I love London. One of the things I, very early on in the pandemic, during the first lockdown, we got bikes and we rode down to the West End. And that was, I didn't like that so much. It was so empty, so desolate, and it just felt wrong. You know, cities should be thronged. They should be bustling places. They should be like, you know, full of life and everything. And so it wasn't great seeing it like that. But yeah. Other than that, you know, I mean, like you've got everything here. So I mean, like, from that point of view, you know, you kind of like, I guess it's a lot easier in many respects, maybe in London than it might be in certainly in sort of more sort of like rural places, more out of the way places, you know.
Yeah. Spider, I mean, I know you've been in the music game a long time, are people still taken by surprise that you're not Irish? Do you still find that?
Yeah, actually, it does happen. I mean, like, we never sort of, it's kind of always been the case, though. It's something that we've kind of got used to, I guess, you know. You know, we never, obviously, you know, never tried to sort of pretend that we were Irish. It was very always very clear that we were sort of a mixed bag. I think, you know, always more of a London band, really, than anything else.
Yeah.
Of tradition of London bands, you know, I mean, Shane's songs, a lot of the time they are from the sort of, you know, from the point of view of the diaspora, of the exile, you know, of the members of the diaspora, I should say. And but they're also, like, he's written some really brilliant London songs. I think some of the greatest London songs that have been written.
Yeah, and you know, you grew up in Eastbourne, Spider. Not.
No, I was born in Eastbourne.
You were born in Eastbourne, yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in London.
Okay, and
I lived in London since I was eight, and we moved around with it.
Okay, yeah, and how young were you when you kind of discovered music? Because I remember thinking about my own. I was thinking about this. You know, I was kind of high school. It was kind of madness. I was probably about 11. The back end of the Jam. Can you remember kind of your first kind of initiation into enjoying music?
I mean, I think it's a funny question that, because I was asked that recently, actually, in another podcast, and I sort of went right back, and I sort of, basically the answer I gave was like the first time I heard anything that was like a sort of, you know, a pop song, which would have been like when I was about four or five, and hearing like hearing the Beatles, She Loves You, I think it was, in point of fact, on the radio in Eastbourne. But I wouldn't say, I couldn't really say, oh, then that's, and it was from that moment on, you know. I mean, it was just, that's just a memory that's kind of stuck with me. But I think in terms of like really sort of having my eyes and ears and everything else opened, I think there was some really sort of like, I think discovering Jimi Hendrix when I was about sort of 9 or 10 years old was a real big deal.
Mm.
And sort of when I sort of, you know, when I discovered bands like the, I stumbled across the Velvet Underground on the back of a record review I read in an old British rock magazine called Cream, not the double E. Cream, that's the American one, but there was a British version spelt the normal way, and they had a review of the Velvet Underground's Live at Max's Kansas City album, and I think it was either Nick Kent or Charles Shaw Murray or one of those old school rock journalists, and he was just the review was basically the whichever one of them it was writing it. It's kind of like harking back to listening to the first Velvet Underground album. It's some grimy sort of basement flat somewhere in like Warwick Avenue or somewhere, you know, with a sort of two-bar electric fire. And I just thought, and then sort of and reviewing this live album, which was only like, I think, retailed at sort of £1.49 or something. And a really good live album, but I just sort of fell in love with the whole thing through this review. Yeah. The music press in those days could certainly do that. They had you had people who could really write, and there's many records I bought on the strength just purely of what somebody else had said about them.
Were you a big collector of vinyl? Were you one of these kids that went out and just spent all your pocket money on vinyl or not?
Not especially. I mean, I did when punk happened, much more so, but. Before that, no, I was given a bunch of my sister, who's 8 years older than me, when her and her husband-to-be, when they sort of left the country to go off on the sort of hippie trail to Nepal, they just left a whole bunch of records with me, which was like stuff from sort of Dylan and the Beatles, and through to people like the MC5, Jimi Hendrix again, a whole sort of swathe of like the whole swathe really of 60s music almost. You know, there were sort of bands in there by people like Spirit and Quicksilver, sorry, records in there by bands like Spirit and Quicksilver Messenger Service, Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane. There was like The Who live at Leeds. There's just a great, you know, Laura Nyro. Like Joni Mitchell, but you know, it was apart from some obvious omissions like Joni Mitchell, it was a pretty comprehensive list. So
yeah, what was life like growing up for you, Spider? I don't want to make this too religious, but were you in a religious family, or was there any spirituality going on, or was it or not?
No. I mean, not a sort of my mum and dad would have been like, you know. Would have both said, "Oh yeah, you know, we're Christians, we're C of E, or C of E." but there was no sort of like that. That would have been really as far as it went. It was a purely sort of nominal thing.
Yeah, and I was reading that you were expelled from high school, and I was wondering about that rebellious stage. I mean, all teenagers or most teenagers go through it. Was that kind of intentional? Were you intent on causing havoc, or was it just the victim of circumstances? What was it?
I was more of a sort of like, I was more of a sort of persistent absentee, a sort of persistent truant. Mm. I didn't really sort of cause trouble at school. The actual sort of straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, was we had to stay, there was a chemistry lesson basically where the teacher didn't turn up and everybody was just kind of messing around. And then somebody else came in, another teacher came in sort of at the end of it and said, right, you lot have been like, you know, behaving like animals or whatever, and you can all stay behind. And me and this friend of mine who had just been sort of sitting there quietly talking felt, well, we haven't actually been sort of really doing anything particularly animalistic, so we're going to go home. And for that, we were sort of told to come back when we thought we could behave. And I kind of took them at their word and came back 6 weeks later or something like that.
Yeah.
And they sort of say, well, we feel that you might be sort of happier in an out-of-school environment. But, you know, it was just shortly before the mock O-levels,
right,
which I always thought, given the sort of insistence that they placed on this kind of thing, being grammar school and all this kind of crap, I thought it was like, how much, you know, what do you sort of really care about providing an education here? But then again, at the same time, I hadn't sort of like bothered turning up to receive my education a lot of times. So I suppose one could have that point of view.
I think it's quite interesting because it mirrors my similar journey to myself. How did that go down at home? You know, were the family supportive and kind of right, let's look at a different line of attack for Spider or Peter? You know, what was the feeling at home when that happened?
It wasn't really sort of particularly remarked upon, actually. it was like, you know, suppose you better go and get a job, you know. I mean, I wasn't really I think it was kind of recognized that I'd never enjoyed going to school. I felt sort of like something that had been imposed upon me without my consent. And I just had the sort of thing that if I didn't want to go, I just wouldn't.
And
I think it was just like, okay, well, you know, you really don't like school. Guess what? You don't have to go anymore. Here you go. You know.
So which way did you head? Did you get a job? You got a
car wash.
Yeah. Car washer.
Yeah.
and you were happy though, but you were happy though, I take it. You were content.
Yeah. I was glad to be out of school. Like I say, I didn't enjoy having to go. So and it was fun working at the car wash.
Yeah, and Spider, I'm sure lots of people have asked how you met Shane and the band, but I'm really, you know, more interested. When was it you actually realized that you as a band had the potential to do great things, you know, and you thought that something's in the atmosphere that could be positive for us?
I mean, I think I had my first, it had always been apparent, you know, from Shane's previous band, the Nips, that Shane could, you know, was a great frontman and everything, but also that he could write songs. But when he, the very first Pogues gig, he had I think he had Streams of Whiskey and Dark Streets of London, both of which are great songs. And then the first rehearsal we did after that gig, he turned up, he had Boys from the County Hell, certainly that, and I can't remember what else, but it was Boys from the County Hell, which just seemed to sort of like, it seemed like it just sort of poured out of him. But I mean, obviously he had written it, you know what I mean? It was the way that it just kind of like that rehearsal went, and I just thought, you know, yeah, we're really, really onto something here. I could just sense that there was this was more than just kind of like, it was more than just simply messing around and having a laugh, you know.
Yeah.
It was very, very early days, but there was absolutely definitely something there. The first time I actually sort of really copped on that we ourselves were turning into, so, I mean, it happened a couple of times. There was, we used to play the Hope and Anchor in Upper Street. And the first couple of times we played there, the very first time we did okay. The second time there's maybe about, sort of 25, 30 people there. Upper Street is in Islington in North London. The Hope and Anchor was a really, really popular and really well-known venue, sort of fixture on the pub rock circuit. It was only a very small room downstairs, but like everybody played there. And it was just one of the places to play, you know. So after this second gig, Shane and I were sort of stayed behind after we were having a drink with the guy that ran the place, this guy John. He was like saying, you know, I don't really know if you guys are if you guys are really right for the Hope. And we were like, John, come on, you know, give us another shot, give us another chance, you know. So he said, all right, and he gave us another gig about maybe sort of 3 weeks after that, 4 weeks perhaps, and the place was packed. That something had just, you know, there was a momentum that's just kept gathering pace, and so that continued in that interim. It continued to happen. Then all these people were there, and there was a time when we were playing, I think after the Elvis Costello tour, a little bit sort of after this, the only tour we've ever supported anybody on. The first tour we did, we supported Elvis Costello, and then we had a show on our own at the Clarendon Hotel in Hammersmith. Which would have been St. Patrick's Day, I'm going to say 1985. I think it was 85. I couldn't swear to that. And Shane and I went up Dowling Road to do some photos in a park or something, like that. And we walked back down, and I could just see as we were coming back down to sort of like Hammersmith Broadway, I could see this sort of like crowd of people, and the Clarendon was like at that point there was this like sort of big sort of traffic island. It wasn't really a traffic island, it was too big to be a traffic continent. Some kind of landmass in the middle of the road, you know, in the middle of a roundabout, which is where the Clarendon was. And I saw all these people milling around, and I was like, what's that then? And I realized it was a queue for the Clarendon that had come, that was like meeting its own tail, you know. Mm-hmm. And I, yeah, it was like, I, yeah, you could see then, okay, this is there's definitely now.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, we're on fire. But you know, you sort of, I think you know when your own band is really good.
Yeah.
And I knew we were a really good band. I just knew it. I knew Shane's songs were like unusually, you know, high quality, and the sound that we made was like, yeah, not like up.
Did it surprise you, the quality of the songs, Spider? You know when you're kind of in the pub having a conversation with Shane, was he talking in that kind of language that you thought this guy's got some incredible lyrics in him, or did he just kind of rock up and go, done this? Just tell us a bit.
It wasn't a case of sort of like, what, you wrote this? You know, it wasn't like that. He was, you know, he's a very, very erudite and intelligent guy, you know. So but it was just the, you know, there's good songs and then there are songs that are just like, oh fuck me, that is a good song. they were so good that I suppose you could say, yeah, it wasn't a surprise exactly, but it was certainly it was like, Like I said, you know, you knew that there was something here that was just like really out of the ordinary.
What do you think it was? It was more than just... Yeah, Spider, what was it? What was the magic chemistry that, you know, got people queuing around the block? Was it the image? Was it the sound? The songs? Or was it the whole lot, do you think?
Well, I think it's the whole package. But ultimately, I suppose that we had a lot of second generation Irish people, a lot of London Irish people turning up at the early shows. They weren't by no means the sort of the totality of the audience, but you know, there was a lot there. So there was a lot of people who just simply really got off on the fact that we were doing, like, you know, all these old songs that they're sort of like their mums and dads or their grandparents might have played, and they sort of, people got a kick out of that. And actually, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, I always thought that music was like kind of like, oh no, I can't be listening to that. And then it was like through you lot that I actually realised that no, it's really, really good, you know. Plus, of course, there are plenty of people who thought that anyway. I just think the whole thing, we were always like a really, really good night out. And I think, you know, that's you know, if you can't provide that, then you're not really going to get very far. I think that's the bottom line, you know.
Yeah.
It's dancing. The end of the day.
Yeah.
Can I have a glass of water? Sorry.
Yeah. And Spider, and when, you know, the band's riding the crest of the wave and all those people are enjoying it, were you enjoying it as well? Was it as joyful for you and the band as it was for the audience?
I always really enjoyed touring. You know, playing live. I wasn't the one who had to sort of stand up in front of all those people and sing. And I think it is very different, having done it as a singer as well. I kind of understand that it's kind of harder. And especially, I think, when they, you know, for songs that you've written yourself, that you've probably put quite a lot of yourself into, maybe it can be quite hard. But also, just simply, what I'm trying to say is, I always really enjoyed it. But we really worked too hard. We did too much, and there was a period between, I think, 80, from when Fall from Grace was released. We did something like 285 shows in a calendar year, which is just mad, really. You know, we just did not stop to take a bit of time off ever, and which is, you know, ultimately what led to Shane kind of, I guess, really burning, you know, just becoming disenchanted and sort of burning himself out almost, you know.
Yeah.
And I do actually completely sympathize with that. I think, you know, if we'd when you get to that sort of point in 1990 when we sacked him, what we really should have done, if we'd been sort of thinking clearly about it, we would have done, would have been to say, right, okay, let's just take a 6 months or a year off, you know, and recalibrate, recharge.
And Spider, if I can ask you about that, I spoke to a few guys, spoke to Rick Witter from Shed 7, who talked about their band breaking up. And I just wonder how that was for you, that period after that, you know, after the kind of the, you've been riding this high, all these gigs, and all of a sudden it's over with Shane as the front man. Was that a difficult time for you?
Well, it would have been much worse if we hadn't sort of been able to replace him with Joe Strummer, which just like, from my own point of view, was just this kind of like ridiculous sort of teenage fantasy come true, you know what I mean? So I was like, oh, well, you know, I mean, like, you win some, you lose some. Which I think is how quite a lot of the sort of like the audiences kind of felt as well. I mean, Joe enabled us to keep going. I think it might possibly have been, you could say maybe it would have been better if we'd stopped when Joe decided to carry on doing what he was doing on his own, you know. But, you know, we got another two albums out and lasted until 96. By the end of that, it was really so apparent that it was, you know, that particular dog had its day, you know. Well, this day was a long time ago. So,
Spider, I went to see Rick Butler from the Jam talk about the breakup of the Jam, and I found it quite moving and sad actually that, you know, these young guys who started out as best friends had enormous success, and then it all ended through Paul Weller's choice. They've never really kind of got back and celebrated the success. Is that something you've been able to do with Shane? What's your relationship with him today?
Well, actually, I mean, I haven't actually seen Shane for a bit, but I mean, like, it's you know, everybody gets on fine. But you know, we had that whole period of the reunion, which was actually went on for longer than the band did in its original form.
Yeah.
By 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, and you stepped in as frontman for a while. What was that?
I was, to be perfectly honest with you, I was drinking too much at the time for it to really actually have ever been entirely satisfactory from anyone's point of view. You know, so I didn't enjoy that so much.
Yeah, and the extent of your songwriting, Spider. I mean. You know, I'm not blowing smoke up the proverbial, but you know, I think Tuesday Morning's just a fabulous song. I really do. I just think it's just fabulous. And you know, where did your songwriting begin, and where is it now? Is it? Do you still write music? Do you still write songs?
I do. Yeah. I'd always, you know, I'd had a punk band before the punks called the Millwall Chainsaws, and I was a sort of. I was the main songwriter in that, if we can dignify it with, well, yeah, I was the main songwriter in that, in the Chainsaws. And I had a band after the Pogues called the Vendettas, which we have an unreleased album, well, an unfinished album, I think is the more accurate way of putting it. And I still sort of write the occasional song, but I don't, I'd never really wrote much for the Pogues. Apart from anything else, I just really thought, you know, what's the point? Why would we want to clutter up these records with our own stuff when Shane is so eminently capable of producing greatness? You know, that's not to sort of have a dig against anybody else who did write songs, and you know, I mean, there's things like Thousands of Sailing is a fantastic song. Andrew wrote a couple of songs on the two post Shane albums, which I think are really, really good. I think Andrew's a very underrated poet, if I might say so.
Yeah, and another hero of mine was Chris Difido, who came on the Godcast, and I love the way he used the term, you know, that his career was at the other end of the corridor. And with the greatest of respect, Spider, you're a similar age to Chris Difford. You know, what's your kind of reflection of the life that the Pogues have given you? Is it one of immense pride and joy? What is it?
It is, actually. I'm very proud of the Pogues. I think I'm very lucky that it's sort of like it was something that I kind of fell into almost, really. Well, I suppose, is that true? The sort of stage seemed to set itself, actually. as far as that's concerned. I guess though, being in the right place at the right time, but being in several, you know, being in the right place at the right time several times, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I was looking to, I couldn't actually find an awful lot, but how the Pogues were received in America. What was the kind of feeling and sentiment towards the Pogues out there? If you could just share that with us.
The Irish Americans love us, as you can imagine. But I mean, we were never like huge in the States, but we achieved what I could say, you know, like cult status, certainly. Mm. Again, with the reunions when we went back to America, you know, we got really, really, you know, it was a good turnout. We played big places with great crowds.
Yeah. And could you just share us a few memories of Kirsty MacColl? I mean, I was growing up when Kirsty was putting out music, and she put out New England, which I think was a Billy Bragg song, I think, but
yes,
I just adored it and adored her voice. Just tell us a bit about Kirsty. What was she like as an artist to work with?
Kirsty was great. Kirsty was just one of those people that really just can only ever add to anything that, you know, could only ever add to anything that she was involved with. I knew Kirsty quite well. Kirsty was just brilliant in every respect, really.
Yeah. And Shane, I love music so much, Spider, and I'm interested in so many different genres, but do you think that without those kind of well-documented stories of Shane's drinking do you think the genius would have been there without that or not? Do you think it made without kind of Shane's drinking problems and fallouts and the, you know, do you think it made the band what they were?
I always think ultimately when, you know, you hear that sort of said about a lot of people, you know, was it their demons that actually make them what they were? Mm. And the sort of, if you buy that, by the demons, you mean whatever it is sort of inside them that sort of makes them sort of seek whatever it is they are seeking by sort of like indulging their sort of appetites, whatever that may be. Hang on a second. Let me rethink this. No, I don't think so. No. I think, you know, the talent is there. I think there are certain things that can shape that and into the sort of dictate the way that it comes out, if that makes sense. And I think though that thing can possibly be the same thing that sort of can, you know, lead to people sort of drinking too much or taking too many of the wrong kind of drugs. But I think I don't believe that you can't produce the art without, say, the drink or the drugs. I think maybe without the sort of like the slight, I'm struggling to find the right word. I don't want to use the word madness because I think it's pejorative and helpful. Without the inspiration, without the sort of like the grace of the muse, then obviously it's then you're nowhere, you know.
No.
But I don't think that the muse comes to you, I don't know, you know, through a bottle. I mean, it might seem that way. It might seem that way when you're sort of like, you feel that you're like, oh, you're relaxed, the sort of like your inhibitions in every kind of like respect to sort of like maybe, you're the thing that might be sort of stopping you from creating. You might feel that maybe people do feel quite, you know, like it's like, I always found, I haven't had a drink for like 24 years or something. One thing I always found was if I was playing pool in a pub and I'd had about 2.5 pints, I was like actually usually quite good. 2.5 pints, I could sort of, I hold my own. But stone cold sober, or like over 3 pints, and either way, I would not be. There was definitely a happy point where I could do it. So yeah. I don't know. It's a tricky one, that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one. I mean, there's so many.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is a good extended answer. Thanks, Dido.
John Coltrane is a very good example. John Coltrane got really heavily into heroin and everything, essentially because he believed that was the way that led to sort of like, you know, that would lead to inspiration and creativity. And then he kicked heroin in the early 60s and then produced his greatest works. Post heroin, so I think really I would look to John Coltrane for the answer to that question. Actually, that's the
it's so interesting. My favorite band,
I was just saying about A Love Supreme, you know, that's a guy who's essentially straight, or certainly not doing smack anymore.
Yeah, I was my favorite band, the Depeche Mode, who had all sorts of turmoil, you know, and they all kind of went off the rails. But I just always felt that their best music came when they were in that state, really, and that's why I asked the question, I think,
a lot of it's to do with age as well, I think. And that again is very much down to the individual, you know, not how old they are, but where your head's at, I guess, is probably more to the point.
Yeah. And
we could talk about that all night long.
Well, I love it. I just love all the psychology music and stuff. And this song, Fairy Tale of New York Spider, must have been asked so many times, but is it an Achilles heel for you? Or is it something to be celebrated?
What you mean with the all the recent stuff?
Well, just it's ongoing kind of success. It's kind of, you know, it's perennial, kind of coming out and people loving it. You know,
Fairy Tale New York it's taken on an entire life of its own. I think it no longer belongs. It hasn't. It belonged to the Pogues for a long time now, because of its becoming what it is. You know, it's so it's, you know, when we in the apart from the sort of like a realization that, you know, oh, it's coming up to Christmas, you know, and if we were touring, oh, okay, we have to do Fairy Tale. Other than that, it has a complete life of its own.
Yeah, and in terms of songs and live performances, Spider, I mean, you said you've played hundreds and hundreds of gigs, but are there any that kind of come stand out in your mind as kind of just events and moments in time that you'll remember forever?
Yes.
Can you share a few of this?
Well, I mean, like the one that immediately springs to mind is the first time we played the Barrowlands in Glasgow. And then I would probably say after that, the sort of second and third and fourth times that we played the Barrowlands in Glasgow. But the Pogues anytime we play Glasgow, really, actually, the Pogues in front of a Glasgow audience is something else entirely. And that's, you know, I mean, Pogues crowds, I've seen, you know, many, many bands down the years, and I've never ever seen an audience like a Pogues audience. The only thing that particularly a Pogues audience in Glasgow, but that's just the best example, if you like. It's the only real comparison is a particularly joyous football crowd whose team are like winning 7-0 or something and just keep scoring. Kind of thing. It's like being in the end behind the goal and just like, and everything's going off.
Yeah. And Spider, do you ever have the appetite to get back together for kind of one last hurrah as you know, or are you content? I know you're doing live gigs this year, aren't you? You're content doing what you're doing?
I am. I'm entirely content doing what we're doing. I don't think there's, realistically speaking, you know, the last time the Pogues played together was in 2014. And realistically speaking, I don't see any way that can happen again. I think Shane just isn't really sort of physically in any sort of condition to do it. And I don't think I'm, you know, that's, you know, if anybody's who's seen the film or whatever, will probably, you know, will know what I'm talking about. And, you know, actually, you know, and Shane's actually not the only one who sort of age or infirmity has kind of, or whatever, has got the better of. So, yeah, no, I think our day is done, yeah.
Yeah. And Spider, I don't know if you've ever done Desert Island Discs, but I was wondering if you could take one, you're going off to a desert island, you could take one Pogues record with you, which one would it be? And it's a single, not an album, buddy.
A single, not an album.
You can't take the album, you can just take one song with you.
I can take one song. I'd take the Broad Majestic Shannon.
Okay, tell us why.
It's just beautiful. Mm. It's just beautiful. The first time I ever heard that, I'd missed the rehearsal where Shane showed it to the band, and I walked in and they were doing it. No, I hadn't missed it. I was late. Sorry, missed it. I was about an hour and a half late, and I just walked in and it was kind of pretty much as it is, except it didn't have the whistle. The whistle part just like fell into place. Like, you know, I just picked up and started playing. It kind of played itself. It's, I think, one of the most, you talk about the sort of the exile experience sorry, bear with me a moment. There's a line in it, a couplet, I should say, saw the men coming home from the fair at Shinrone, their hearts in Tipperary wherever they go. And it's that one line, I think, their hearts in Tipperary wherever they go, which is, I just think it sort of says everything about that sort of, about that being separated from somewhere that you love, that is where you're from.
Yeah.
Or it could be one or whatever, but it's that sort of sense of loss and of yearning.
Mm-hmm.
And the song sort of is about that kind of sense of yearning and that sort of, like, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful
Thank
song.
You. Thank you, Spider, for that. It's wonderful to hear. Yeah, nearly done, Spider. And just so you are going out on the road doing some shows. Are you going to be in the UK performing?
No, we'd love to be able to bring it to the UK, but it's costs are against us. I'd have to fly. We have to bring like six people over from Louisiana. Seven, and it's prohibitive. You know, we given the money that we'd be likely to actually earn, if the fees were right, then it would be doable. Yeah.
Yeah.
And as things, just, you know, we'd need to have a bit more. We'd need to be able to pull in a bit more cash.
Yeah.
Mate.
And just the last question: you still love music, Spider? You still seeking new music? What's your inspiring you at the moment? Do you go back to the old stuff, or
there is so much good stuff, I think, around at the moment. There's some really, really, really brilliant bands and just great people making music. I would like to particularly shout out to the Fat White Family and Lancome.
Okay.
Especially the Fat White Family, actually, but Lancome and John Francis Flynn.
Okay.
More Mother, Lisa O'Neill, More Mother again. Christ, my mind has gone blank.
It's all right. I think it's great though. I mean, I went to Tramlines Festival in Leeds last year and purposely set out looking at some young bands, and you're absolutely right, Spider, some fantastic young musicians out there. And they're working in a difficult environment. You know, they don't make money like they did back in your day. And,
no, absolutely, you know, not.
You know,
totally different playing field. It's, you know, we really had it. We were very lucky to be, you know, to be starting a band at that time was probably the best time ever to really be, you know, to be starting out.
Yeah.
Possibly the 60s. But no, I think the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s were, you know, you could get away with murder.
Literally.
People that pay you.
Spider, I've loved chatting to you. You know, I just love music, and it's been a real privilege to talk to you about just such an iconic career in music. And, you know, we just send our love from Lancashire. And, you know, if you do get some dates in the UK, I'll be first on the list, definitely, to come and see you. Love to come and see you. So we send our love, Stider, from Lancashire. All the best to you, and thanks again.
All the best to you in Lancashire. Cheers now. Take care. God bless.
Thanks, Spider.
Thanks.